Yeah. Turn off the motherfucking radio. You know what I'm saying? Turn on the people's radio. It's Big N1, one half of Dead Press, keeping it RBG'd up for my people, because the people come before everything. Before the dollar, before pussy, you know what I'm saying, before weed. And right now I'm doing it. Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM. You know what I'm saying? www.freakradio.org. Freak that. And fuck the police and all of that shit. And I'm out. One.
Thank you, dude.
Yeah, turn off the motherfucking radio. You know what I'm saying? Turn on the people's radio. It's Big N1, one half of Dead Press, keeping it RBG'd up for my people, because the people come before everything. Before the dollar, before pussy, you know what I'm saying, before weed. And right now I'm doing it. Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM. You know what I'm saying? www.freakradio.org. Freak that. And fuck the police and all of that shit. And I'm out. One.
Thank you, Dave.
Yeah. Turn off the motherfucking radio. You know what I'm saying? Turn on the people's radio.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, freakradio.org. Oh, I think I'm supposed to say I'm Naomi Klein.
Freak Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM.
Target locked on.
Pirate Radio at its finest.
There's an unlicensed broadcast station here, and we want to make sure that you stop operating.
There is?
Nothing you have heard before will prepare you for this. The sound of radio is being revolutionized by the masters.
Go!
Is anybody listening out there?
FCC, you know what that means?
Yeah, it means Federal Communications Commission. They can drive around and triangulate wherever the hell a radio signal is coming from.
Yeah, so fuck it, right?
Good idea!
Freak Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, for freakradio.org.
Good idea!
This week on Making Contact...
I don't really think we'll fix our dysfunctional food system unless we start fixing our democracy, and we have to fix our democracy.
From farm to fork, few things matter more than the food we eat. We all want the freedom and opportunity to choose what ends up on our plate, but when a handful of companies control most of the brands you see at a grocery store, what choices are really left?
Over the last 20 or 30 years, these companies have become exceedingly powerful. They've become so powerful that they're able to actually dictate food and farm policy.
On this edition, Winona Houter, executive director of Food and Water Watch and one of the nation's leading healthy food advocates, says it's time to turn the tables on big agribusiness. I'm George Lavender, and you're listening to Making Contact.
IRS at war with Pastors for Peace. The Reverend Lucius Walker, the leader of the IFCO group, Pastors for Peace, is no longer among us. He worked for many years in solidarity projects with the embattled people of Cuba and Palestine. He is gone. But IFCO, Pastors for Peace, are still with us and still working to be a presence of peace in places that seem to be itching for war. At the behest of right-wing hate groups, now the IRS is on the attack. That's because the far right hates any group which doesn't support their imperial vision and works to put Americans in touch with the people of the world, no matter where they are. And now that the IRS has been criticized by the right, it seems like they're now taking on left and anti-imperial groups like IFCO, Pastors for Peace. IFCO, the first national foundation controlled by people of color in the U.S., is now targeted by the government to strip it of its tax-exempt status. Amazing. It's been active in the struggles for global peace for nearly half a century, making friends between Americans and other nations. When Reverend Lucius Walker was alive, he brought thousands of American young people to Cuba to learn and to practice solidarity. That good human work is being threatened today, and only you can help. Remember, an attack on IFCO, Pastors for Peace, is more than an attack on one group. It's an attack on the human and constitutional rights of Americans to speak out, to dissent, to travel, and to practice one's faith. The late Reverend Lucius Walker led Pastors for Peace because he was moved by the message of St. Matthew 25:35 in the New Testament. For I was an hungered, and you gave me meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Help IFCO, Pastors for Peace, continue their work by contacting Congress members to demand that IRS cease this harassment against IFCO, Pastors for Peace. Contact the Treasury Department to demand that the political persecution of IFCO be stopped. Support IFCO, Pastors for Peace, by donations to fight against this political attack at IFCO News, IFCONews.org, or call 212-926-5757, or send a check to IFCO, IFCO, at 418 West 145th Street, New York, New York, 10031. Help keep Reverend Lucius Walker's dream of world peace and global solidarity alive from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
It's the 420 Drug War News. I would hope by this time that most of you out there have seen those stories on CNN, MSNBC, Fox, and elsewhere about the young kids that need medical marijuana in order to survive, or at least to thrive. Here's a discussion I had with the mother of one such child.
Yes, my name's Penny Howard, and I'm mom to Harper Howard, age 3.5, who has a CDKL5 disorder. That's cyclin-dependent kinase-like 5. It's very rare. There's about 500-600 people worldwide that have that disorder. And the biggest symptom that we battle for her on a daily basis is seizures that are not controlled by any current anti-epileptic drug on the market today.
Well, you know, Penny, the thing is, I keep seeing these stories in the major broadcasters talking about the kids in Colorado getting mm-hmm. access to this more refined drug, I guess, if you will, called Charlotte's Web. But yes. Where do you live?
I live in Texas.
You live in Texas. So you don't have access to Charlotte's Web, so you're taking the best, next best medicine you can find, right?
Yes, sir. And I know people are moving to Colorado in order to gain access to Charlotte's Web. There was a couple of reasons that we chose not to do that and that it wasn't a viable option for us. One is that it uproots our family away from our support system, because even if Harper were to take Charlotte's Web and it were to reduce her seizures or even stop them, we still have a child that requires intense medical needs, and we need our family around to help us, and so we can't really uproot ourselves away from them. The other is that it kind of traps us in the state of Colorado. We would be unable to travel to anywhere with her, and we have some doctors that are out of state, out of the state of Texas, and we don't want Harper to be trapped within a state. So staying in Texas near our support system and introducing her to industrial hemp oil allowed us to get help in seizure reduction and better quality of life without confining her to a certain area.
Given your situation, you are just doing the best that you can. Now, you mentioned the use of the industrial hemp oil, and as I understand it, Charlotte's Web is more akin to hemp than perhaps the more powerful or THC-laden marijuana, if you want to call it
right.
that. Mm-hmm. But you're able to get this from Whole Foods or on the web, correct?
You cannot get it in a store, but you can purchase it online. We get ours directly from the company itself, but you can purchase it on various websites online as well, such as Amazon and things like that.
Thank you, Penny, for your courage. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
And coming up next on Free Radio 101.3 FM, which is what you're listening to, it's a slightly late edition of Bathrobes, Beers, Broadsides with your favorite host, Robert Norris, in the studio with me. It's Madcap Michael, yes, that's quite appropriate. He'll be with us perhaps, well, you listen in and you'll find out. Don't go away. I'll be back.
The homeland, a problem for only one reason. That president raises the question, who owns a land? The homeless, our problem for only one reason. A president raises the question, who owns a land? Who owns the land? Who?
Genocide, where is home? And I don't know where home is, but I'm in the studio, and wherever you are, you should feel free to call into Free Radio if you have something to contribute or just a comment or reaction or a breaking news bit. In the studio with me is the infamous, as I said before, Madcap Michael O'Grady. Hello, Michael. Say hello.
Oh, yeah. Hello to everyone, and hello, Robert.
Say something again. I'm not sure we're getting a good mic.
Oh, okay. Counting. 1, 2, 3.
No,
four.
It's not microphone. Is
it? Oh, it's not working very well.
So, well, maybe it is.
It's this line.
Oh. It's this line here.
Is it better if I hold my mouth up?
It's better, I think. Why don't you can hold it up or you can put it in the stand. We have a very makeshift system here.
I'll hold it up.
Okay. So, let's proceed. I'm going to play... begin the show by playing a bit from last night's surveillance seminar about the kind of takeoff from the article that John Malkin wrote for the Good Times advertising throwaway, usually pretty throwaway-ish, but in this case, Malkin had an interesting story. Squared his position with me by acknowledging the only person to speak at City Council against the license identification software that the police are now using federal funds to install, and they can spy on you all you drivers with your license plates and so forth, not just your when you're in your car, when you're near your car, going into your driveway, whatever, even if you're not guilty of any crime, even there's no indication of how long records are going to be retained. I don't think I got an answer to that when I asked that question at the City Council when it was being brought up, and nobody else, including the distinguished Councilmember Michael Posner, had any objections whatsoever to this. But this was a forum concerned about surveillance. I guess you were there, Michael. Any thoughts on that forum?
I thought it was an interesting forum. The room was pretty much packed, and everyone was excited and had an idea. I suppose one man there, I don't know what his name was, he thought the council members who were taken in so easily by the police, by the power of authority, that they should he thought they had pretty low IQs. They had enough IQ to get elected and convince the people, maybe for their own self-importance, but they weren't able to see beyond the safety issue involved in these cameras to the surveillance and infringement of individual freedom that lies behind the so-called freedom, minimum freedom that comes from that kind of dragnet.
In case you don't know what we're talking about, I'm going to play a little bit of what Malkin actually said at the forum, and you can, of course, go online to the Good Times article called Surveillance City and check it out. It was also videoed, and I suspect it's going to show up as a video on YouTube and perhaps in some other places. Maybe Santa Cruz Indie Media is going to cover it. I saw Bradley was there from Indie Media, so that may happen. Great coverage of the parade, the parade supporting the Santa Cruz 11 on Tuesday, which actually was on... it was on Tuesday the 11th. Support the Santa Cruz 11 on the 11th. I was in the parade, as were, I don't know, 60, 70 other people. Began small, got bigger, and it was beautiful weather for it. I actually did some audio, which I may or may not get to today. I've got tapes galore, so we'll see where that goes. Let's begin with a little bit of Malkin. I'm not going to play a lot of him because I think other people did do the video, and that's going to be played in its entirety at different places. It'll be archived, so you can look at it. And let's hear a little of it. I may, in the studio, one of the panelists, Jay, may be coming in. He wasn't really able to speak because Colin Campbell Clyde just couldn't shut up at the forum, unfortunately. Colin is a good speaker, and he's got a lot to say, but he took up other people's time and went into great detail around NSA stuff, which I found interesting and educational, but disrespectful of the other folks there at the forum. That's too bad. But I think it's also not intentional. I think Colin just gets carried away with his stuff, and Steve Plaich, the moderator, was tearing his hair, trying to get Colin to end his presentation. I think it was all very educational, frankly, and it's worth a listen. Again, whether it will result in anything, I don't know anybody did any actual organizing there. I guess there was a little bit. Posner, the city council politician, talked about changing things and organizing and apologize, mea culpa, talked about getting a new city council together and organizing new candidates for the next election, all that kind of stuff, which I, you know, have nothing wrong with doing that. The problem is he has powers now that he's unwilling to use. He doesn't want to offend other staff. He doesn't want to make you appear to be the lone wolf on the city council. Speaking as a lone wolf myself, I don't mind being a lone wolf. Although I prefer to, you know, have the company of other wolves, such as the infamous O'Grady here.
It takes some courage, as you know, to be a lone wolf. Nobody wants to be in that position in a certain sense. They're all afraid of being alone, you know? And it takes a lot of guts. But after the meeting, I asked the presider there.
Steve Plage?
Yeah, I don't know him, but I asked him if he would mind announcing another meeting next month to have the continuity of the energy there for another meeting down the line. But he wouldn't do that, and I thought that was a big loss, that all those people were pretty focused and they all had opinions, and there should have been another meeting, even if it was a month or
problem,
two down
the problem was twofold. First of all, this was an ACLU meeting, and the ACLU in Santa Cruz is notoriously bad on local issues.
Right.
They are a fundraising group for, you know, themselves and the regional, I don't know. They claim to have more ACLU members in this county than almost any other county in the state. This is a very liberal county, but of course what members don't realize is that they're supporting a bunch of right-wing assholes at the city council, where the ACLU is, you know, it has, for example, as a primary speaker, he spoke last night, not on the forum, but from the audience, somewhat hoarsely, what I call him is a motormouth Mike Rotkin, who I guess I'm pretty motormouthy myself, and so I can be fairly called that. Mike Rotkin, however, has held a position of mayor 5 times, and each time it's gotten worse with him. And at some point, if anybody's interested, they can look up on IndieBay, look up Norse Rotkin, and you'll find the kinds of things that Rotkin has proposed that involves shutting down public comment at city council, restricting access to different public areas, supporting the sleeping ban, trying to enjoin protests, not speaking up on behalf of the right to serve free food, all kinds of issues that Rotkin is horrible on, and got to power, and when he's in power, showed himself as to what he was. Although he's a nice enough man, friendly conversations with him last night. He's very amiable. He's always got a great smile on his face. He's very good as a politician. Unfortunately, politicians are the toxic shit that we have to deal with in this society. And I don't say that Mike is a piece of shit in terms of his personal life. Mike Rotkin actually has, there's something on the wall, there's a mayor's proclamation right there I'm showing to Michael. It's signed by Mike Rotkin supporting Free Radio Santa Cruz. And, that's good. Of course, Cynthia Matthews also signed on, and she's probably one of the most horrible people. Probably even, I want to say, is she more horrible than Mike Rotkin? It's hard to tell in terms of her. She's still on the council, so I guess you can consider her certainly more of a threat to the civil liberties of people attempting to eliminate Joel Miller, the pastor of the Red Church, because she doesn't like his meal. She wanted to have him removed from his position as an ecclesiastical person there. Cost him $25,000 in court fighting Matthews. Matthews lost, but you know it showed her bent. In any case, let's hear something from Malkin, less from Norris, and maybe even something from O'Grady. You never can tell at some point.
I hope everyone has seen this article in the Good Times. I brought a few extra copies. There are few up there, and it's online on the Good Times website. And I first noticed this realm of license plate readers coming to Santa Cruz potentially. It was written about by Brad Cava in the Santa Cruz Patch, and it was just a short little article, and it sparked my attention. I'll tell you a little bit about license plate readers. Who has not read the article? Okay. I'll explain a little bit about license plate readers, a little about the grant that came from the Department of Justice to the Santa Cruz Police Department to buy these surveillance devices, and then a few ideas about resistance and privacy related to all of this. These devices are put on police cars and also put wherever the police want to put them, actually on bridges, on signposts. The deputy chief of police came to the city council meeting in September and asked for 8 of these cameras. They take a photograph of every car that drives by and identifies the license plate. The police have a hit list of cars that are wanted for being stolen or connected to other so-called crimes. If the license matches a car that is driving by, an alarm goes off in the car, and the officer can pull over the vehicle and go from there. A lot of these license plate readers also take a photo of the whole car, not just the license plate, and some of those photos include where the car is, who is in the car, who's nearby the car. All of these devices also record the GPS location and the time that it was taken. They take photos over and over. It doesn't stop once there's a hit, for example. And these are used all over the country now, and in England as well, quite a bit. Often people can have 50, 60, 100 photos of their car over a period of a year. And often part of the problem is that the data from these cameras is saved sometimes forever, sometimes for 5 years, sometimes for 2 months. A few police departments save them only for a day or a week or 2 weeks, but that's not very many of them. A man in San Leandro, California, north of here, Mike Katz-LeCabe, who I interviewed for the piece, he asked the police department there for the photos that had been taken of his car, and he got about 100 photos of his car over a period of 2 years. And one of the photos was clearly in his driveway, and his daughter's getting out of the back doors of the car and him getting out the front door. He had a lot of problems with that being revealed. Michael Robertson in San Diego asked for the photos that had been taken of his car by San Diego police, and he was told, "We don't give out the photos. It's private information because there's an ongoing investigation of everyone in San Diego all the time." Some people end up arguing about should the data be private or public, and that's an interesting thing. That's not the most interesting thing to me. And it actually becomes a strategy of how to resist license plate readers if the data is public or not. The mayor of Minneapolis, there was a newspaper in Minneapolis that asked for the data of the mayor. What photos have you taken of the mayor's car over the past year? They got 41 photos. They published them in a map in the newspaper. The mayor, very shortly after that, said maybe we should relook at the policies and procedures. So, yeah, and that's an interesting point. Where is he going? So it leads to a lot of questions about what's important about privacy? What does surveillance reveal? How does surveillance affect people, whether or not they're doing something so-called wrong or criminal? For me, that points to the most important part of this is the expectation of privacy and what happens when you're having private, emotional, in-depth conversations, communications with people, and how that changes when you know you're being watched, regardless of how the data is used. That's one part of this that is significant, I think. In September last year, a grant came to the Santa Cruz Police Department. It's not clear, actually. For me, it's not clear how that grant got to the police department, if they asked for it or if Department of Justice offered it to the police. I'm trying to find that out. But they were offered about $37,000. They've used this money for a variety of things in the past. they decided to, the deputy chief of police came to the city council and said, we'd like to spend this money on license plate readers. In interviewing city council people and city manager and, well, a lot of different folks in town, it seems that no one really knew what license plate readers did and the kind of data that they build up over a period of time. The city council voted unanimously to approve that grant to buy license plate readers. One city council person asked one question at that meeting, and he said, how many of these do you want? So he said, 8. That's how many Milpitas has. And so one person at that meeting spoke against the license plate readers, and I'm grateful for that. Robert Norse was there at the city council meeting and said he would prefer if the city council did not approve that grant going for license plate readers. So they did approve that. Through Public Records Act requests, I discovered who the Santa Cruz police were in contact with, the manufacturers of license plate readers. There's a bunch of them now. They're making good money. Some of them, like ELSAG, E-L-S-A-G, that's one of the manufacturers that Santa Cruz has contacted. They're owned by a company called Finmeccanica, an Italian company that actually is the 8th largest defense contractor on the planet. They build the 8th most, you know, numbers of warships, warplanes, armaments, and license plate readers. For me, too, what is interesting is that there's more invasive and intensive digital surveillance technologies available and being researched and developed now. Facial recognition. So I'm guessing that if police are excited about being able to identify all cars all the time, which license plate readers enable them to do, if you have enough license plate cameras around and they're photographing every car all the time, they'll know where every car is in a city. And ostensibly, because the data is shared nationally, they'll know where everyone is all the time in a car. I think they'd be even more excited to know where all people are all the time. And that's what facial recognition is about. They're developing cameras to do the similar function with people, identify people by photographing their faces. Iris scans and drones, which are not used yet by police in this country, but police are developing ideas about doing that and policies and procedures for potentially doing that. I'm thinking of the license plate readers as being partly the way the government has talked about drugs and there being gateway drugs. License plate readers are kind of gateway surveillance tool to more invasive tools. It in itself is rather invasive and new, and it's fairly typical what happened in Santa Cruz. It has happened across the country where the introduction of license plate readers happens without any community input. This is the first community meeting about license plate readers coming to Santa Cruz. The grant was approved in September last year. I'm trying to find out if they've already bought them. They may have bought them and installed one of them yesterday. That's simply true. I hope it's not true. A lot of the grants come from Department of Homeland Security to buy these license plate readers. And a lot of that entails an agreement that the data will go to Department of Homeland Security. This grant apparently came from Department of Justice, isn't directly connected to the Department of Homeland Security. I discovered that there's 78 fusion centers across the country fusion intelligence centers. One of them is Northern California Regional Intelligence Center. The director is Mike Sena, and I had an interview with him, and he told me he got into the intelligence realm of work on September 11th, 2001. And I think in some ways a lot of this harkens back to that and some spoken and unspoken ideas about what we should be willing to give up to supposedly be safe. The Northern California Regional Intelligence Center is located at the Federal Building in San Francisco. They collect all the license plate reader data that comes from about 200 law enforcement agencies in California. He told me that he has had contact with Santa Cruz. There's no agreements yet exactly about sharing and storing data there, but they have had contact. My sense is that this whole notion that if we want to have safety, and the deputy chief of police who came to the city council who said we need to have these license plate readers, he was saying stolen car numbers are going up in Santa Cruz, there's more crimes, we need some tools to deal with this and make Santa Cruz safer. I think the idea that if things are more safe, we have to have less freedom and privacy is a false dichotomy, a false presentation. It doesn't need to be that way. That applies out to the larger realm of the NSA. It's pretty interesting timing with all of this and all the information coming out from Snowden almost daily. 6 billion people around the world their data is collected every day by the United States government. That's amazing. In some ways, it's true that it's people suspected and knew about spying, but the size of it is tremendous. Also, this comes up a lot, the idea that everyone has cameras now, or I don't do anything wrong, so you can take my picture, take 100 pictures of my car, I don't care. I think Edward Snowden, I quoted him at the end of this article, he did this little Christmas video. Did anyone see that? It's just 3 minutes long. The end of the video, I thought it was really interesting. He said a few times, privacy matters. It's almost like people think privacy is not valuable. Or, actually, privacy means you need to go somewhere to hide something you're doing. He's pointing out that privacy actually matters. It's in privacy that you know who you are and you envision who you want to become. And you do that alone, you do that with other people, and you can't do that if someone is watching you, grading you, criticizing you, judging you. The license plate readers have already been used to track political dissent in this country. It's not surprising. Police, FBI, CIA, NSA have always used whatever tools they have to do that, to crush democratic movements domestically and internationally. COINTELPRO is a great example of that. It happened to be maybe the most violent period of that, which included assassinations of political dissenters in the United States. But already license plate readers in New York, the police there used them to photograph people who were at political rallies, people who attend mosques. Some folks have pointed out there was an article in Popular Mechanics, which I don't think of as a highly charged political magazine, but it presented this article that was really thought-provoking. This writer said, hey, here's a thought experiment to do. What if we ask police, what if we put up monitoring equipment, license plate readers, to watch where police go all the time and what they're doing all the time? They would never agree to it. And in fact, it's interesting. In Boston, the police have been asked by their administration to have all of their cars installed with GPS devices, so they'll know where all of their officers are all the time. The police didn't like this idea. And as far as I know, they have protested, actually, I think the police officers union, and so far it hasn't happened. Ironically, in the same city, the Boston Globe recently did an investigative report on license plate readers. Boston police have been using them for quite a while. The Boston Globe, like these other people I mentioned earlier, they made a request and said, send us the photos you've taken of cars with license plate readers over a period of, I'm not sure how long, a week or a month. They picked a specific time period. The ACLU there tells me that there were three things that were really interesting about the data. One was they sent them a ton of data. So much that the police were actually embarrassed later. It was kind of a breach of data sharing. That wasn't the most interesting thing, though. They noticed that the license plate readers were being used to focus on particular neighborhoods, lower income and African American Latino neighborhoods. The other thing that was very interesting, probably the most interesting, they noticed that some cars, there was actually one motorcycle that had 50 hits. Every time they photographed this motorcycle, the alarm went off and it said, pull over this motorcycle. Well, they're wondering, why didn't they pull over the motorcycle? Like after the 33rd time, you know? Or so this leads the ACLU and Electronic Frontiers Foundation and others to believe that the license plate readers are being used for something besides what they're telling them they're being used for, which is collecting data on everyone and being able to go back in time, essentially, and look at where people have been and who they've been associating with. I'm going to end with a few ideas about creative solutions. I would like to see license plate readers not used in Santa Cruz, especially not until there's a really clear discussion that happens, looking at the pluses and minuses of them. I'm concerned that the design of these devices leads to the potential of mass surveillance. It is a form of mass surveillance. They're not designed just to look at something and give an alarm. It collects the data on every vehicle. I would also, in kind of a larger context, if we do want safety in our community, certainly there are there's violence in Santa Cruz. There are people taking things from each other that they haven't been given permission to take. I would like to see neighborhoods and people creating actual ways to deal with that without calling the police. And I have hoped for that for a long time. It's a little little bit of a large job. Ultimately, I'd like to see people contacting the police less and creating self-reliant neighborhood groups and creating art and using creativity to do that. There's ideas I've heard of creating a constitutionally protected zone in Santa Cruz, which ties into this, declaring Santa Cruz a compassionate city, which ties into this. And I had a funny idea on the way over here. I got, as part of the request I made to the Santa Cruz Police Department, they gave me this little booklet that's called Mobile Forensics Field Guide, What Every Peace Officer Must Know. So, you know, police get trained in how to search for things that are connected to supposed crimes. So now, of course, they're trained in how to look in digital data to do that. It's kind of a large realm. In fact, I mean, it blows me away to hear people in government say the most important realm now for being in and controlling is digital data, is the cyber realm. Part of what I found in this, and I'm happy to pass this around, this is telling police officers how to search for digital data. These Back when I was a kid and living near Hollywood and seeing in head shops little things to store illegal drugs, you know, cans of Coke, but they're not really cans of Coke. There's like a little hiding thing in the bottom. This is warning police that people might hide digital data. These are jump drives that look like other things, kind of like those other little hideaway things. So one of these looks like a Swiss Army knife, but it's really a jump drive. One of these looks like a piece of sushi, which is a little weird. But this idea I thought of on the way over here is to create zones that are privacy zones. I would like to see Santa Cruz as a whole be a privacy zone where freedom of speech is really held and people can feel free to get together and talk without fear of being watched. It's already not that way because there's a lot of cameras around. There's something in here that I hadn't heard about. It's called a Faraday bag, invented by a guy named Faraday. If police grab your cell phone and they want to get data off of it, it's possible for you to call your phone and remove the data. The way they make it so you can't do that, they put it in this bag, and it blocks waves from getting to the bag. Yeah, so I had this idea riding my bike over here. What about a Faraday cafe? And what about a Faraday Santa Cruz, where you go and you know that you're not going to be listened to, watched, have your data grabbed, any of that. And there's plenty more information in the article, and I'm happy to answer questions later. And I'm grateful to see so many people here tonight.
And that was John Malkin last night at the Surveillance City Forum. In the studio with me is Michael O'Grady. Any comments, Michael, on anything you've heard? You don't feel obliged to say anything unless something pops up. We got plenty of stuff to talk about.
No, I thought John's explained it pretty well. It's pretty clear. The question is, what are the people going to do about
it? Yes, that is the question. I was circulating a kind of a – it wasn't really a petition. It was a forum which encouraged people to list where they either had observed or suspected there were surveillance cameras, particularly outside in downtown Santa Cruz, but anywhere, including inside stores. So we will know, how much we are actually being surveilled when we walk through Santa Cruz. And that doesn't mean that merchants don't have a legitimate basis for surveilling. I went into New Leaf Market up in Felton today, and I left my wallet somewhere, and I couldn't find it. And so they were going to go check their surveillance tape to see if they could see where I might have put it down. And that's a legitimate reason for it. And I suppose certainly for stores concerned about theft, they want to gather evidence, they want to deter theft. I'm not too big on New Leaf's thuggery by having guards stalking around their downtown Santa Cruz store. I don't think that's a welcoming thing. I don't think that's a positive thing. I think it also it tends to, reverse the reality that if people are considering stealing food from stores, things are getting pretty bad, is my thought. You know, and some of it may be, the nonchalant, a traveler philosophy and so forth, and, you can always get free food in Santa Cruz. Well, some can, some can't, and it's also a sign of the times. In any case, I had this surveillance downtown sort of sign-up list and pointed out, and I put it on the list, requests made to city government to determine the location of surveillance cameras as well as the length of the time that the video records are kept has not been responded to yet. And I'm going to hopefully keep pressing on that issue, and I encourage other people to do the same. Turn in your own Public Records Act request. All you have to do is send an email to the city council, the city clerk, the city manager, or the mayor saying, I would like to know the location of the surveillance cameras in Santa Cruz, any documents which document that, and also any documents which document how long the video records from those cameras are kept. Very simple statement, and they're supposed to respond within 10 days with that information or some excuse as to why they can't. They haven't responded to me yet. And so I'm going to have to take after them. I'm only trying to do 73 things at once, and so I often things fall through the the cracks, and so I encourage people to, you know, take their own action on this. I ask for people to assist in helping us locate and clarify the location of all surveillance equipment in downtown Santa Cruz that spies on Santa Cruzans in the downtown area. Please list all locations you have reason to believe are being surveilled, as well as all businesses that maintain video surveillance inside or outside. What I got from people, and this wasn't something I could do really comfortably because people were, you know, trying to listen to the speakers. There was a certain period of time afterward, but it didn't really. I got there late, so I wasn't able to circulate before the meeting. But I did get a few responses, and I'm going to post them. But for all of you lucky listeners who are listening, and I'll let you know in advance. Again, this is not documented. These are suggestions as to where these cameras might be, and for us to look into them so we know, you know, where the cameras are. And these are the suggestions: Elm Street corner, across from the Metro, by the Pergolesi. Somebody thought that was the first alarm office. That's new to me. Maybe that's true. Near the Cinema 9, parking garages, Santa Cruz Public Library on Washington Street, police station back doors, near Stagnano's Fish Warehouse, the clock tower, the traffic control cameras that are all over the place. That's what Mike Rotkin mentioned to me. Eco Goods, outside Eco Goods and New Leaf on Pacific Avenue, outside the Santa Cruz Coffee Roasting Company, overhead in the lobby area. Generally, hidden cameras along Pacific Avenue, Cruzio's Internet outside building, every side, why so many cameras, someone asked, and the Metro Center, the Metro Transit Center. So those are some places that I was thinking, if we want to create a map of all the cameras in Santa Cruz, those might be places to go if we want to confirm that's the case. And also, of course, I'm hoping that people will give more information about this issue if people are interested in knowing who's taken their picture where, to some extent. I mean, I always advise people who are complaining, let's say, about someone openly videotaping them or taking their picture in a public place, that's the right of anybody to do, to take your picture in a public place. You have no what they call expectation of privacy, is my lay understanding of the law. However, for government agencies to do so is a really different kettle of fish. And that's what I was thinking as I listened to John Malkin talk about how the Boston police didn't like having GPS put into their police cars. Two things. First of all, when the government starts taking pictures of people and keeping files on them for political purposes, it's, first of all, illegitimate because it crushes or chills dissent. It deters people from going to political meetings if they know their pictures are going to be taken or their conversations overheard. People have to want to be able to speak without thinking everybody in the world, their political opponents, maybe ideological opponents in the police department, are listening, looking for something that they might have said that might lead to some kind of attack on them one way or another. Well, John also mentioned that, you know, you need privacy to develop your individuality, to be yourself. If you always feel you're under scrutiny, you're going to act differently than when you have some privacy. And that doesn't mean you're going to spend your time, you know, murdering small children when you're in private or torturing animals, although I imagine that happens. But, you know, it's all kinds of other things that enable you to become more of the individual you are as you grow up and as you go through life. But the reason that police officers... you might say, well, police officers have, you know, are just as sensitive in a way, because that was John's, I think, whimsical point, that even cops don't want their cars given GPS. There is a reason why we do want cops to have GPS in their cars, and that is because they're not just private individuals. They are, in fact, paid by the taxpayers to engage in public safety activity, and they are not generally monitored in an effective way by any oversight agencies. They suppose that there's an internal affairs or professional standards unit in police agencies, but these are internal agencies, and it's, you know, the police abuse is legendary in the sense that when it happens, it takes a long time to uncover. Very few instances of police actually being prosecuted exist, more now that there's video evidence. But even, for example, in the Fullerton case where the police beat to death a homeless person, they weren't convicted of a crime, ironically, because the video evidence supposedly showed that they were doing the proper kinds of blows as they murdered the guy or created damage.
They look like wild dogs to me, killing a rabbit or something.
But you want to know where the police are, and that's a legitimate concern. And it also, you know, it's a way of stopping police corruption. They have to be it verifies that they can't just simply cover for each other by lying about where they are. And you might say, well, why would you suspect our police officers of doing this? And the answer is, people in positions of power have got to be more carefully watched because they have more options than those who are not in power. And it can be, you know, it's something that just is a temptation for those in power, particularly if there's a tradition of corruption, as there seems to be in some police departments. So getting back to this whole issue of the Surveillance City Forum, I went back to the original... to the original video of the council meeting, which was on September 24th. It was item 24, a justice assistance grant. And I noticed a couple things, which actually I just passed on to speaker and writer John Malkin. I just left a message on his phone. Maybe he'll call in. Who knows? And by the way, people, you're invited to call in if you have some thoughts on this subject. The phone number here is 427-3772. The justice assistance grant, as it was presented to the community, as it appeared on the city council agenda, which would be both online and presumably posted where you can view it during the daylight hours at city council offices, but not at night where it's illegal to go walk on the city council grounds after 10 o'clock at night, states this. Resolution amending the fiscal year 2014 budget in the amount of $61,916 to accept and appropriate justice assistance grant funds to purchase traffic monitoring equipment and to distribute $24,208 of the grant funds to the County of Santa Cruz. Notice the words license recognition software does not appear in this description. So people who are concerned about privacy issues, except those of us who are, like myself, rather suspicious of and want to scrutinize rather carefully all grants to the police department, wouldn't really give this a second look. When you do give it a second look, and you can online by going to the agenda report, you can read the following. If I can, of course, get it up without losing my way here. The background of this. The Justice Assistance Grant, JAG, allows local governments to support a broad range of activities to prevent and control crime based on their own needs and conditions. JAG funds can be used for local law enforcement programs, including targeting crimes of violence, gang crimes, auto theft, and planning and technology improvement programs. The procedure for allocating JAG funds is a formula based on population and crime statistics in combination with a minimum allocation to ensure that each state and territory receives an appropriate share. In some instances, such as this year's funding is determined to be disparate. Under this structure, two law enforcement agencies share in the predetermined amount, a set amount of money. This year, our agency, the Santa Cruz Police Department, is in a disparate funding structure with the county sheriff's office. As such, we have entered into an interlocal agreement with the county. Utilizing these guidelines, fiscal year 2013-14 funds would be expended to address issues of violent crime and combat a significant rise in vehicle theft. The Santa Cruz Police Department plans to use our funds, and finally we get to it after three paragraphs, to purchase and deploy the necessary equipment and data servers for a mobile automated license plate reader, ALPR, ARP, traffic monitoring system. The county sheriff's office will use the funds to hire a consultant, thank you very much, to study the feasibility of an outdoor firearms training facility and to improve audio and video in monitoring at the main jail. This is the great liberal Sheriff Wowak who wants to, you know, supposedly use $24 million to improve conditions in the jail, which groups like Sinbaris have been fighting, suggesting we don't need more jail expansion. We need real activity in the community to deal with issues outside of the jail so people don't get there. Here's a discussion of this, again, with, from the staff report of the license recognition software. Police department is working to combat a significant rise in auto theft over the past 2 years. In 2012, the city experienced a 42% increase in reported auto thefts. In the first 6 months of 2013, we have experienced a 16% increase in reported auto thefts. Additionally, the city has experienced a number of violent crimes that are associated with the use of a vehicle. These crimes include homicides, drive-by shootings, gang crime, and robberies. ALPR technology, that's license survey identification technology, has proven effective in combating these crimes and providing critical information and investigative leads for jurisdictions that have deployed the technology. By providing critical information and investigative leads, this system can be instrumental in increasing our solve rate of violent crimes. Deployment of this technology can assist in reducing the number of reported stolen vehicles, as well as increasing our recovery rate of stolen autos. The cost to purchase, install, and deploy all the necessary equipment is estimated at $38,000. Any remaining balance will be made up with asset forfeiture funds, that's the drug war, folks, generally, or vehicle funds left over in the current fiscal year's budget. Police department intended use of the funds falls within the stated goals. It doesn't actually say how much this is going to cost. It says they're going to spend $38,000 of it and then more money as well. That's submitted by, prepared by Steve Clark, one of my least favorite police officers, deputy chief, approved by Kevin Vogel, one of the most nice guy, but forget it. Chief of Police, and Martine Bernal, city manager, the most powerful and highly paid official in the city, who supposedly had his record looked at on Tuesday, but that was in closed session where the public did not have access really to any kind of discussion unless they A, knew they could do it, and only 2 minutes before the whole thing has happened and no discussion, no real opportunity to look at the city manager. I raised this issue with Councilmember Postner, and a number of occasions he ho-hummed it, as far as I could see. In any case, let's turn now to the actual video and the audio portion of the video. You'll be able to hear it, of that city council meeting and the discussion that they had on this issue. And this is again... am I in the right place? Let me double check. Here we go. I think this is it. Boy. One more time here. I've got to find the right meeting. And we will be there. My apologies for the primitive technology. We're going to make it, though. You are tuned to Free Radio, by the way, in case you forgot. And the phone number here is 427-3772. It's amazing how... Well, let's see here. Could this be it? I think we're close. Item 24, I believe, is the item. And there it is. All right, so we're going to go there, and we're now going to listen to some of item 24.
And our presenter this evening is Deputy Chief Steve Clark.
Good afternoon, Council Members, Mayor. You've had a long day. I'm going to just get to it and just give you the information as quickly and as succinctly as I can so that we can move on. So I feel like I'm watching one of those old Godzilla movies, watching the delay on the screen here. I speak.
The large mayor behind me.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, the Justice Assistant Grant. What this grant really is this was formed actually from the Bureau of Justice Assistance in memory of Officer Edward Byrne, who was a New York City police officer, killed in 1988. And so the grant was formulated in his memory to honor him. What this grant funds is various law enforcement equipment and activities throughout the United States. It's administered by the Bureau of Justice Assistance, a federal office. What we're asking for is a budget adjustment this year in the amount of $61,916. A portion of that is going to go to the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Office because we're in what the Bureau of Justice Assistance calls a disparate situation. if you're going to ask me to explain the math behind this, I'm not sure I can. But essentially, it has to do with crime rates and who is eligible as the money is dispersed amongst all of the states and then all of the counties in the states and then all of the cities in those counties. The Bureau of Justice Assistance specifies the dollar amount. It is predetermined. We don't apply for a specific amount. They tell us this is what you're eligible for, and because we're in a disparate situation, we have to co-apply with the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Office. Now, we've entered into an interlocal agreement with the County of Santa Cruz for this money, and essentially, we become the pass-through now for it. So that's where that money's going from. This leaves $37,000 of it for us. In previous years, what we've done is we've bought cars with this to help sustain our fleet during lean budget years. To help us keep that fleet going, we've taken that money and bought both marked and unmarked police cars with the JAG money. And I'm going to call it JAG, Justice Assistant Grant, so that I don't have to say that word too many times. That's what I mean by JAG. It's not the TV show. All right. So this year we've made a decision that we'd like to move forward and utilize ALPR technology, automated license plate reader technology. Why ALPR? It's a technology that we feel is right for Santa Cruz at this time. It's a technology that's widely used by a number of law enforcement agencies throughout the state, throughout the country, in fact. The County of Santa Clara recently purchased an ALPR unit for every agency in the County of Santa Clara utilizing grant funds, and they've already seen significant returns on that investment. As you know, much of our crime here in Santa Cruz is vehicle-borne. We tend to import a lot of crime that comes into Santa Cruz as different people come to enjoy our area, as well as our gang crime. We also tend to import a lot of that. The information from an ALPR system would be invaluable to investigators as we follow up on serious and significant crimes that we've had. We're also a pass-through and a destination location. Many of the state alerts, they go out. Individuals pass through Santa Cruz. It's just the nature of being a coastal community. We're also a destination for a lot of individuals who come into our ALPR technology. Will help us identify those individuals, know that they're in our area, and take the appropriate enforcement action, if necessary, with those individuals. Let's take a look for a minute of some of the most useful ALPR technologies out there. First and foremost is the ability to identify stolen vehicles. As in my agenda report to you, we have just seen an onslaught of stolen vehicle reports here in the city of Santa Cruz. Last year, we experienced a 42% increase in our reported stolen vehicles here in the city of Santa Cruz. In our first 6 months, we had another 16% increase on top of that 42% from last year that we've seen. ALPR technology has proven to be extremely successful in helping to identify stolen vehicles, identify individuals associated with those stolen vehicles. In fact, many of our neighboring agencies are seeing at least one a week that is picked up by utilizing their ALPR technology. The Highway Patrol alone has recovered over 800 stolen vehicles utilizing ALPR technology. The County of Sacramento, their probation department, not even their police officer, but their probation department has these, and they just recovered their 300th vehicle utilizing this technology. So it's proven to be very effective and very good feedback mechanism. I'd like to also take a look at our gang crime that we have here. Much of our gang crime is vehicle-borne, as we know. We saw the situation on Mission Street where, again, that was vehicle-borne crime. We were fortunate in that we found that vehicle quickly, but with ALPR technology, we could have had the ability to find that vehicle even faster and not lose critical leads that we did lose in the lag time there. I would also point to the Pauly Silva homicide just down the block here. That was a vehicle-borne crime. In fact, we suspect that many of our incoming units might have driven past the suspect vehicle as they were leaving. Unfortunately, we didn't have a description to go off of at that time, but ALPR technology would have allowed us to capture all of the plates of the individuals in that area, including suspects and witnesses that we lost in this and individuals who claimed to not be there. This would have significantly assisted that investigation and moved us forward to solving that and bringing justice to the individuals responsible for that. I'd also point to the Joey Mendoza homicide, the 13-year-old that was killed down off of Bixby Street in San Lorenzo. Again, a vehicle-borne crime, and again, ALPR technology would have helped point us to potential suspects in that and bring that to a faster resolution than what we're currently working on now. So, other violent crime that this would have helped with, I think about the UCSC student who was shot in the head out at the bus stop on Natural Bridges. Vehicle-borne crime. She gave us a description of a car that she had seen circulate in that area prior to that crime. ALPR technology could have helped us to identify a potential suspect vehicle in that particular case. And, you know, it's not always just about solving the crime. Oftentimes it's about assisting in the missing person case, the child abduction case. I think about the Deanna Brooks case, the missing antiques dealer now who's been missing for quite some time. I would love for it if there was a law enforcement agency somewhere that had her vehicle on ALPR and to give us a lead, give us something to go on to help find that woman and get some answers back to her family. So the benefits of this extend far beyond just finding stolen cars, finding suspects, but there's a lot of potential uses for this that we're missing out on by not having this. Talk about the effectiveness. There have been very few quantitative studies on the effectiveness of ALPR. One that was recently done in January 2012 was the Police Executive Research Forum. In that they polled law enforcement leaders from throughout the country, and what they found is that the hit rate for recovering stolen cars was up to 50% higher using ALPR, as well as their arrest behind significant violent crimes that have occurred in their community. Again, that number of 50% more. There, like I mentioned, there's a number of other cities now who've deployed this technology that surround us. I think it's technology that's right for us right now. I think we should be taking advantage of that and giving us this tool to utilize and to move forward with. That's why we're asking for it. And that's all I got.
That was pretty thorough. Thank you, Deputy Chief Clark. Councilmember questions?
I have a quick question. You know, I know other cities that have this technology, they also install them sometimes on the parking meter readers or the parking meter staff. Is this something where we're looking at maybe a plan where having multiple readers, or is it just what's a sufficient number for a city of our size?
Well, you take a look at a city like Milpitas. Milpitas is very comparable in Santa Cruz, both in size, population, budget. The city of Milpitas has 8 mobile ALPR readers that are out there. There's 2 different ways you can deploy this technology. Our initial dip into the pool of ALPR is going to be through the mobile units. Eventually, we'd like to look at the effectiveness and look at something that might be a fixed location. So you can do mobile or fixed location ALPR units. We're going to start with the mobile. Milpitas has 8 of them. They're a city of similar size to us, and I know one of the lieutenants in charge of that program very well. I've known him since grade school, and he raves about the effectiveness of this program and what this does for them in their crime-solving capability. In fact, he relayed to me an anecdote, a story of an ALPR hit they got on a homicide from Monterey that actually landed in their city where the suspect had painted the car a different color. But because of the ALPR technology, they were able to get that hit, get that individual in custody. And it was a homicide of a family out of Monterey, so it was both a child and a mother that was killed. So those are just some of the success stories behind that. We'll look at the mobile. There's certainly the fixed option available for us, and if this is effective, we would look to expand it in the future. Many of you are familiar with a thing that we do called Project ROPE. You've probably heard us use that acronym. It's essentially when we have a major crime that happens, we have some description, we go out to fixed locations in the county, all the ingress egress points, and sit and watch. Well, we can't always cover them because of staffing needs and concerns or just plain availability of everybody throughout the county. That would be an ideal application, is to put ALPR units in all of the predetermined Project ROPE locations. That would be something we can look at in the future. This is funds that are available now. We have the ability to kind of dip our toe into the pool, see how we like the temperature, and go from there.
Any other questions? All right, I'll open it up to public comment on this item.
I know a lot of us have been concerned nationally with the
scandals around surveillance and the gathering of immense numbers of files on ordinary people. And I have no idea whether this ALRP technology is in any way even amenable to that. Perhaps Deputy Chief Clark or Chief Vogel can give some indication of whether files would be stored on ordinary people in this respect. I'm a bit concerned that, you know, while appropriating or accepting money for the police department, because I often see them engaging what I regard as over-policing downtown, massive numbers of folks to show up for a smoker on Pacific Avenue, now on a side street as well, who is not regulating himself properly, or a homeless person sitting in the wrong place who wants to stay there because he somehow feels he has a right to sit down. Goodness, why? Where would he get that idea? So I'd like to see crime diminish, and I'd like to see what stats this police department has regarding its effectiveness in retrieving stolen vehicles in the last 2 or 3 years. Perhaps they can, you know, demonstrate how they've been using the money that has already been appropriated to them and the devices they've already had. I'm sure that they have those stats, and I'm not saying that they haven't been effective. I'm interested in hearing the rise in these auto and, I guess, earlier heard about bike theft rates. I think that's a significant factor we should be aware of. I don't want my car stolen, and the police have on 3 occasions retrieved my vehicle, which I thank them. But I'm just wondering what the actual situation is in terms of stats and also the protections that the ordinary Santa Cruzan has here, much as effective a tool as this may be for dealing with car theft. Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening.
Yeah, my name is Cam Acall. Look, there's way too much crime. We got to have this. It's today. It's too bad. It's kind of spying. But we got way too much happening that's bad. 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 We got to do something about it.
Thank you. Any other speakers to this item? If not, I will bring it back to council for action. Move approval.
Second.
Motion by Matthews, second by Lane. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? That passes unanimously. Thank
you. Get into it much, though.
And that was, you know, the City Council meeting of September 24th on the license recognition software. The whole discussion, including Steve Clark's presentation, I didn't even say I opposed it. So I can't really take credit for opposing it. John Malkin initially said in his story, and again last night more specifically, that I opposed it. And I think I constructed that memory in my mind too after reading his article. But I didn't. It looks like I was simply asking questions about it, trying to get more information. Yeah. None of the people in City Council wanted that kind of information. Although the retention records is a very interesting question and I think a pertinent one, and of course one that was brought out at the forum last night. Secondly, this was not on the consent agenda as I had initially claimed. I don't know if I mentioned this before in this broadcast. I mentioned it a couple times earlier. It was on the regular business agenda, and I was denouncing the consent agenda and Michael Posner's failure to take items off the consent agenda. Michael later told me, well, I did take this off the consent agenda. Both he and I were wrong. It wasn't on the consent agenda. It was on the business agenda. But you do note that the idea of license recognition software is not mentioned in the description of the item, which most of the public picks up when they pick up the agenda or look at the agenda. So it's not surprising that there wasn't much discussion about it. Although I've got to say, there are a lot of people who have in the past been concerned about NSA surveillance and, you know, big supporters of Edward Snowden and Bradley and now Chelsea Manning and, you know, Julian Assange and Glenn Greenwald, all these folks who have been instrumental in revealing the criminal nature of the extent of U.S. spying on U.S. citizens. And I say criminal because that's what it is. If somebody who is a private person were doing this, they would be and should be charged with offenses against the community. It's even more dangerous when the government does it, of course. This was an item that John Malkin chose to focus on and did some good research on, some interesting discussion. I think, in a way, some productive organizing around, not by so much organizing, but by informing people about this issue and of his concern about it, both in the Good Times article and in the forum last night. It remains to be seen, as you stated, Michael, you were telling me earlier, I guess, you don't know if you said this on the air or not, that there was... Your concern was that there was no follow-up meeting planned by the ACLU, and I've suggested the ACLU is really a fundraising kind of group. It doesn't want to take on local issues, and also it does take a certain amount of wherewithal to rent the room, and then, you know, actually Food Not Bombs served food last night, good for them, at the political event. But it seemed to me that that was not an unreasonable thing, considering the passions of people who were speaking about it, the reception it was getting, that there needs to be follow-up. And I'm not aware that's happening except as some sort of a fundraising shindig for the ACLU. I don't think they were raising funds specifically at this meeting, but they're looking for people, you know, to join the organization and so forth. But it's certainly an important issue, and there was some local focus. There was some interesting local discussion. I may play some more of that on Sunday, but I want to get on to other things while I still can. And I want to mention a couple things that are happening tonight for those who are tired of listening to Steve Clark and, you know, and me around this issue. Other things that are happening are important as well. And let me find them in my little machine here if they are available. The other stuff that's going down is there's a couple things happening tonight at 7 o'clock. We've already, you've missed the beginning of it, but Cindy Sheehan, candidate for the governorship, a Peace and Freedom Party candidate, will be speaking at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, which is on Ocean, 612 Ocean, if you want to go there. It started at 7. Her campaign is an epic campaign, End Poverty in California. Kind of harkens back to Upton Sinclair's campaign of 1934 when he tried to do the same thing. Actually, kind of an upset. He was able to get the Democratic Party endorsement, freaking out all the right-wingers in the state, and they got together to make sure he didn't get anywhere. Cindy is was, of course, a woman who spoke out strongly against the Iraqi war, the Bush-Iraqi war, and continues to speak out against the war under Obama, though she's lost all her Obamanoids, all the Obama supporters who, want to defend the president, the Fuhrer, as I like to call him, no matter what. So this is happening at 7 o'clock, if you want to go check it out. Mark Levy is going to be performing music. She's running for governor, so, you know. Internationally renowned peace and social justice activist, majored in California history, UCLA envisages a state that leads the world in peace, economic stability and equality, environmental sustainability, and delivering high-quality public education from pre-K through university. And there's a website for her, www.cindy2014.org. That's www.cindy2014.org. Also tonight, starting in 15 minutes, is the open mic at the Sub Rosa Cafe, one of my favorite cafes. I meet there every week with the Huff Gang, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, concerned with civil rights for homeless people. We're going to be having an action next Wednesday, by the way, for those of you who are interested. We are concerned about backpack bigotry. And we're going to be serving coffee on the sidewalk, assuming that the coffee makers come through with the Java, outside the coffee roasting company, which now has a policy of no backpacks, as well as apparently not allowing people who live in the Hotel Palomar to walk through with their shopping bags, which I've just heard about at the Red Church. At least that's the claim of a woman who's a resident upstairs in the Palomar. And we're going to be gathering information from people about what seems to be discriminatory policies, both at coffee roasting, across the street at Starbucks, down the street at Pete's. Although, as I said before, I noticed that Pete's did seem to have both homeless people and backpacks in it the last time I was in there. Well, last Sunday or last Saturday. I was in there again today, and it looked a little more empty, middle class, and nary a backpack to be seen, but it was late in the afternoon, and so it may just be that was, you know, the time of day. But again, 7:30 Sub Rosa, if you want to speak at the open mic, I think anyone can sing, dance, speak, read poetry. And, of course, at 7 o'clock there began the Cindy Sheehan rally with some music by singer Mark Levy. He's got some great songs and has been supportive of homeless civil rights on many occasions. His famous song, "There ain't no sitting in the city of Santa Cruz with its redwood trees and its ocean views. It's the home of surfers and sad gurus. But there ain't no sitting in Santa Cruz. No, don't be caught sitting in Santa Cruz." That was about the sitting ban. He composed that in 1994 when the Coonerty Council, that was the elder Coonerty, Neil Coonerty, but the law, of course, is supported by Ryan Coonerty, who's running for supervisor, first passed the sitting ban on the streets of Santa Cruz. It's gotten progressively worse. Initially, it was after the sweeping ban was thrown out by the courts. It was, I think, 6 feet from a building. Now it's 14 feet from a building that is the forbidden zone up and down Pacific Avenue. And not just 14 feet from a building, but 14 feet from a kiosk, 14 feet from a crosswalk, 14 feet from a bench, 14 feet from a sculpture of any kind. That includes those exciting "don't give money to the panhandlers, feed me" meters that you see up and down Pacific Avenue. And a variety of other trash cans, trash compactors, and so forth. It essentially removes 95% of the sidewalk for sitting purposes. So, those events are happening tonight. You should check them out if you're interested. And let's turn now, however, to some... some interviews. Why not? This is stuff which I have intended to play, haven't had time to play, but is worth listening to, I think, because these are the voices of people that you don't get to hear much. And I'm having a little bit of technical difficulty. That happens sometimes in this neck of the woods. Let's, accordingly, take a much-wanted musical break, and I'll be right back.
You gotta go down. Join the union.
Join the union.
You've got to join.
You got to join.
Join it by yourself.
Ain't
nobody here.
Nobody
can join it for you.
Then you gotta go down and join the union by yourself.
Well, you gotta go down.
Work in the factories would kill a dog. Working on the belt line killed your soul. Working in the limestone and cement quarries withered your lungs. Working in the cotton mills shot your legs and feet all to hell. And working in the steel mills burned up your spirit like a gnat that lit in the melting pot. But out of this whole mixing bowl of hell and high water, the working folk have marched against billy clubs, against machine guns, and they sang their way through the whole dirty mess. Now the bank men have got their union, and the landlords got their union, and the finance men got their union, but down south and out west on the cotton farms and working in the orchards and the fruit crops, it's a jailhouse offense for a few common everyday workers to form them a union and get together for higher wages, honest pay, and fair treatment. Woody Guthrie, 1941.
Well, you gotta go down.
Join the union.
You've got to join. By yourself.
Ain't nobody here.
Can join it for you. You've got to go down and join the union by yourself.
If you want to raise in pay, all you have to
do is go and ask the boss for it, and he will give it to you. He will give it to you, my boys, he will give it to you. A raise in pay without delay, he will give it to you. Oh, put it on the ground, spread it all around, dig it with a hoe, and it will make your flowers grow.
The men who own the industries, they own no bonds or stocks.
They own no yachts and limousines or gyms the size of rocks.
They own no big estates with pools or silken DVDs.
Because they pay the working man such fancy salaries. Oh,
oh,
oh, put it on the ground, spread it all around, dig it with a hoe, and it will make your flowers grow.
There once was a union mate who never was afraid of goons and ginks and the company thinks and the deputy sheriff who made the raid. Went to the union hall when a meeting it was called, and when the company boys came round, she always stood her ground. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union till the day I die. This union maid was wise to the tricks of the company spies. She couldn't be fooled by the company stool. She'd always organize the guys. She'd always get her way when she struck for better pay. She'd show her card to the company guard, and this is what she'd say.
Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union.
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 And that was Peter, Paul, and Mary with a couple of different union songs. I got to say, I'm not a knee-jerk union supporter in all circumstances. If the union is representing the workers appropriately, that's great. Unfortunately, in a lot of cases, you get bureaucrats in power who are not so good. But I'm generally tend to be pretty pro-union. I think it's good to be pro-worker, and that can be an important distinction to make as well. Let's hear a little now from, I think we're going to be listening to the Tuesday parade for the Santa Cruz 11, if I'm not mistaken. But sometimes I am, so let's hear what comes out here. Assuming something does come out, of course. Sometimes there's a bit of a silence before the blast of... Here we are.
It's the 11th of February, 11 for the 11th, supporting the Santa Cruz 11, at least three of whom are here, two of them currently charged, actually four, including Grant. So we have Brent, Grant, Gabrielle, and me, five, counting Alex. So here I am, and we have, looks like the crowd is growing, 5, 10, 15, 20.
For those who are a little mystified, and that probably isn't too many people who listen to the station regularly, Santa Cruz 11 are a group of people, four of whom are still facing charges, facing 4 years in prison, potentially, for essentially being in a vacant bank-leased building, the Wells Fargo-leased bank, still empty across from the current Wells Fargo Bank on River Street. This was an outgrowth of the Occupy movement, which was attempting to expose and contest and hopefully change Wells Fargo and other massive foreclosure fraud activities, which, of course, they're the people who should be being prosecuted, and they're not, of course. Instead, the police and the DA, Bob Lee, have gone after activists, not even the activists who vandalized to some relatively, I was going to say relatively small extent, but there's a disparity in the estimates of the damage. I mean, some say it's initially the amount was $27,000, and then some said $23,000. And there was a certain amount of vandalism that happened over 3 days in this bank, or this essentially vacated bank building, still vacated 2 years later after this is over. But the people who did the vandalism were never identified, and the people who are being charged, the last four, Cameron Lorando, Gabriella Ripley Phipps, Brent Adams, and Frank Angel Alcantara, are not in any way identified as vandals. Their only crime is that they were in the building at the time, and that therefore they were aiding and abetting the crime by being there. And the seven other defendants, of which I was one, and there was others who came to this rally that you're going to hear last Tuesday supporting the four who are still charged and go to trial in early March, facing charges of felony vandalism, again, not because they did it, but because they were in the bank. So that aided and abetted it. And then also the charge of misdemeanor trespass, that going into the property and remaining on the property in violation of the orders of the Wells Fargo bosses who leased the bank and have kept it empty for 5 years. I am currently, I was wearing a little badge today created by Becky Johnson, one of the Santa Cruz 11, that says empty buildings are the crime. And that, of course, is the truth. And the crime is also these kinds of prosecutions. Anyway, this is what the parade is about. I'm going to play some more of my babbling and interviews at the parade, which you can also see very colorfully and well described, well, it's certainly pictured, on Santa Cruz Indie Media, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, small letters, one word, Santa Cruz. And that's by both two of the Santa Cruz 11, who were the first two who are essentially initially all charges were dismissed against them because they were journalists, and there was no evidence that they were engaging in any criminal activity, but that didn't stop what I call Big Top Bob Lee from proceeding against them, or proceeding against the rest of us, or proceeding against the four who remain. They did a great series of photographic shots of this parade. I encourage you to go check it out. Santa Cruz Indie Media is where you'll find that.
For 30 people at least, there's a red anarchy flag. There's some woman on a bicycle, for heaven's sakes, former free radio broadcaster of some kind. And there are, let's say, five Santa Cruz 11 people, two of whom are still currently charged and face 4 years in prison for being in a bank. The flashy, well, they're both pretty flashy. We have Gabriella in a sort of a evening gownish gold lamé sort of affair, and we have Brent, which has he has a gold cloak, boots, and a video camera. He does a little video.
Hey, going.
All right, go for it, babe. And people are wearing T-shirts. I was in the building. Support the Santa Cruz 11. A new website: http://santacruz11.wordpress.com. Try and say that fast three times.
These T-shirts that say "I was in the building" are a statement by people who will tell you, I was in the building, so why aren't I being prosecuted? Why are you going after these four people? And actually, there was only one person who actually came forward. Such was the fear created by these prosecutions. Indeed, we were all facing 7 years in prison under the original charges, which were conspiracy to commit felony vandalism, conspiracy to trespass. And Judge Burdick, after a year, found there was no conspiracy. It's an example of the abusive system we're under and the abusive behaviors of the district attorney Bob Lee and his assistant district attorney Rebecca Young, who was so incompetent or malicious, probably incompetent, we better, that she was the only time I've ever heard of she was sanctioned. The DA's office was fined $500 for her essentially it was contempt of court and refusing repeatedly to give the defense the documents they needed to expose the thinness, or I shouldn't say the non-existence, of the case. And so let's hear some more.
We're assembled here at kind of right outside the parking lot of the Saturn Cafe area. And, people got the new Santa Cruz 11 buttons. There's the famous can of justice where all the justice is being dumped in the can. And there are a number of little gold gold wagon that with a money symbol at the top of it, perhaps symbolizing Bob Lee's determination to be a bag man for Wells Fargo. He's our district attorney prosecuting these cases.
And the reason I say bagman for Wells Fargo is Bob Lee had a conversation with me, which is on videotape and has been posted on YouTube, in which he stated that if we kicked down $27,000, then the case would be a whole different matter. So the defendants don't have $27,000. They're poor people. So it's complete bullshit. And it also, however, shows the financial motivation. I guess he might, to be fair to Bob, he might say this is to prove the, I don't know, sincerity of regret or remorse or willingness to make restitution to poor Wells Fargo, that impoverished institution, for the damage done to its leased building. Again, the disproportion between the amount of damage Wells Fargo does and has done every day for the last decade by its foreclosure behavior is really preposterous. And, you know, one saw for a time when the Occupy movement was growing out of Occupy Wall Street here in Occupy Santa Cruz, people beginning to realize and express their anger in creative, outspoken ways that, you know, actually began to talk about making real change, not waiting for politicians to agree, not writing letters to the paper, but taking actions on the streets, direct action. And this occupation of a vacant bank building was one of those actions that a splinter group from Occupy did. And, you know, a lot of people disagreed with it, you know, the sanctity of private property. Brent Adams, who is one of the people who's being charged, has written how he wishes that instead there had been a defense of the homeless people's camp that was across the street, which for 2 months Occupy protected. But shortly after this bank situation, 4 days later, Chief Vogel's goon squads and stormtroopers, with help from the county police and other police agencies, I imagine, destroyed, giving no alternative to the several hundred people who were living there. And that's the idea that there would be a community center in Wells Fargo Bank was probably an unrealistic one. I mean, it wasn't a bank. It was a vacant building. But the point about the need for a community center was really the issue, that empty buildings are the crime was the issue, that there are vacant bank buildings in a number of places in Santa Cruz, vacant office space, and homeless people outside. And it's true throughout the country, of course. But the fact that that people were going to act on it here was really a kind of a revolutionary thing. And it didn't, you know, it actually, the whole thing, not only did people occupy the bank, but when the police moved to remove them from the bank, masses of people stood in front of the police and resisted them. None of those people were charged with anything. And the police backed off, to their credit, for 3 days and negotiated to try to get them out of the building, and were successful. One of the reasons they were successful is that an individual who is now charged, but there's no evidence she was in the building, Gabriella Ripley Phipps, helped through phone conversations, link up the protesters and the police so that there was a peaceful resolution. And, of course, her reward for this kind act was a threatened 4 years in prison, and she goes to trial in early March. This is obviously, for me, a political attack on the remains of the Occupy movement. And it's not really about the activists, although they did go after those of us. Essentially, they were very lazy, those of us they could recognize visually, who were in the building at all. Not that we'd done any vandalism or anything of the kind. And city council members were in the building without permission of Wells Fargo. Other recognizable community figures, reporters were in the building from Santa Cruz Patch. I subpoenaed the reporter from the Santa Cruz Sentinel. He was in the building without permission. And none of these people were charged with anything, of course. They had no more evidence for them than they had for us. And that was, or I should say, they had more evidence for us than they did for them. And so this is the kind of fraud that, unfortunately, a lot of lies, I think, at the bottom of a lot of the abuses that we see in the criminal justice system and in the society generally. There's a sort of a mythology, this a public safety mythology that has sort of come up in the fore is... It's gotten worse in the last 2 years with the ascendance of the Take Back Santa Cruz mentality and the clean team and the needle hysteria. I really should be talking about what the Board of Supervisors did in terms of the Public Safety Task Force report, which reached them on Tuesday, but I don't have a good report myself from it. I haven't seen much about it in the media. I haven't reviewed the agenda. Maybe I will get to it for Sunday. I do a show on Sunday for those who just tuned in or aren't aware of it, from 9:30 to 1 in the morning. Anyway, let's continue with this. This parade was an attempt to, in a kind of a festive way, make fun of and show a certain amount of joyful anger around the issue of how people don't have houses, people don't have jobs, people don't have health care, people don't have the right to be in public spaces, and instead... This is all some sort of there's a big paranoia that's descended on the city, aggravated by this public safety phoniness that there's a real danger from homeless people and from drug users, and you know that more, and there isn't any more than there ever was. You know, there's always a level of danger in any society that is in the state this particular society is in, but the idea that you're then going to go after political, using this to go after political protesters, using this to go after street performers, is, well, that's what's going on. Anyway, here's some more from that parade.
And we even have a homeless activist who's tagging along. Who are you, sir?
Sir William Blake.
And why did you come to this rally?
Because I feel that what has happened to these victims is unjust, and that somehow we've got to do something to make people take notice.
Well, I hope that works. We have the elderly people like me, and you, sir, what's your name?
My name is Richard Lloyd Vitito, V-I-T-T-I-T-O-W.
So you're not afraid to announce your name and spell your name in the company of these accused felons?
Are there some accused felons here?
Well, there are three of us who were accused and two more of us who are still accused, but they haven't been proven.
They're not here.
And there are two others who are not here, Cameron Lorando and Angel Alcantara. That's true. But there are still people gathering. I see there comes...
Here's some more.
Freedom and Herbal.
3 o'clock Santa Cruz time, so they're still early.
Indeed. That means what? 3:45? Anybody else's time? Or 3:15, actually.
Yeah.
So people are. Indeed.
So, what are your thoughts, Robert, about what needs to be done for the Santa Cruz Four?
Well, the Santa Cruz 11, the four remaining of the Santa Cruz 11, I would say. I would propose things like, you know, marching to Bob Lee's office. I would propose things like parades around. To me, it's not just the Santa Cruz 11. It is also everybody else being impacted by the curfews that they use to crush the Occupy movement, and they're using to harass homeless people. Here comes that erstwhile legal worker, Steve Plage, rhymes with age. Letters to the paper, the usual. Plage has talked about some kind of a deal with Bob Lee. I haven't seen if that is actually going to have any.
Get somebody on the fruit.
Yeah.
And actually, what was proposed by co-founder of the Food Not Bombs group, Keith McHenry, was that people essentially ignore the prosecution and go back and reoccupy the bank. or something similar, exposing, again, the real criminals and refocusing the attention of the community on the people that should really be under the microscope, that should really be stopped from further criminal action, that are really destroying families and jobs and careers and lives, these huge banks. But that is not something in Santa Cruz that has happened. People have been afraid to even talk about these issues. It is, I suppose, a step forward that people have actually come out with. There were T-shirts that now read, "I was in the bank." We tried to. There was an attempt to organize that. I think Brent wanted to raise that issue in terms of solidarity, but he was dismayed to find that many people who had been in the bank would not come forward. and say, and even people who were clearly identified as coming out of the bank, the police had video. It was revealed in Discovery, finally, when we got it. It showed people that were recognizable coming out of the bank, in and out of the bank, and they would not come forward and say that. I think there was one man who did, Ed Fry, who's the activist and attorney who started the Peace Camp 2010 the year before, the homeless protest on the steps of the county building that later moved to City Hall, demanding justice for Robert Facer, a blind bear Facer, who's died since then, who was arrested ticketed for sleeping on the beach because he was trying to keep tabs of his boat. He had a small canoe that he had as an Amish, a minister, he had paddled down, allegedly from Alaska, but more recently from Sacramento. No way to verify that. I don't know if that was true or not in terms of other, but that was the claim. But he was one of the people that was convicted with me of singing songs outside the Coonerty bookstore, unreasonably disturbing noise, which supposedly disturbed a man named Sean, who was trying to sleep during the day, and therefore he felt that the police became the tool, or he became the tool, it wasn't clear, for doing that. In any case, this cloak or miasma of fear does seem to have lifted somewhat, and that was, I think, partially the purpose of this parade, to have people saying, I was in the building, down with this prosecution, stop this stuff. It's already cost hundreds of thousands of dollars and gone nowhere except to, I think, rub the butts of Chief Vogel's police force, who maybe felt embarrassed that they hadn't moved on the group earlier, though I think it was good that they sensibly did not. But they were held at bay for 3 days by citizen action, by action by the community, by at least certain members of the community. Now, admittedly, we're talking, these were radical people. They weren't supported by much of the Occupy movement. But the goal, it seemed to me, to be a laudable one. And the joint goal of establishing a community center, maybe a place for homeless people to be during the cold winter. And this is because it happened in late November and early December of 2011. And also to expose the foreclosure fraud by Wells Fargo, which was happening all over the country. People were exposing it and standing up to it. It's too bad it isn't happening now. So Keith McHenry's suggestion that we reoccupy the bank is not a bad idea, except that it means people have to be willing to face charges, even though nobody's going to get hurt by walking into the bank. It just exposes that the privilege of some large financial institutions shall not be respected. It shall instead be, overturned by the power of the people. Unfortunately, the power of the people has to be exercised to be real. And that we have yet to see in this community recently. Although, this parade was a nice example. It grew to about 70 or 80 people, I understand. And here's some more of it.
Oh, yeah, that'd be good. He is running. Well, you're a member of the Santa Cruz 11.
Yeah.
And you're going back to meet the fun people in court.
Yep.
And have you been offered a deal by Big Bob recently? I've heard that there's sort of schemings behind the scenes going on.
No, not that I've heard of. As far as I know, it's the same deal.
Which is plead guilty, throw yourself on the mercy of the court, and pay up?
Well, it's plead guilty to misdemeanor trust.
This is Gabriella Ripley Phipps, who is one of the four remaining of the final four of Santa Cruz 11 is charged and faces 4 years in prison.
Pass, and then with a conversation about the restitution. So it wouldn't be a felony, but it would still be paying the $23,000 to Wells Fargo.
$23,000, come on, you can afford it. You're a well-known, wealthy individual.
No, I'm not.
No, you're not. No, I'm kidding about that. Well, I have heard from Steve Plaich, who's actually right over there, that he's trying to get the ACLU and Mike Rotkin behind a plan to encourage encourage Bob Lee to moderate his stance. You can charge and not have to pay the rest, or pay the restitution, I don't know, in jelly beans or, I don't know, good works, smiles. Mm-hmm. That probably isn't how he's putting it.
That'd be great. Yeah, I'm into that. I can smile.
Yes, even though there's a sort of a solemn quality to your smile today.
I know.
Yeah. And we've been talking with...
Gabriella.
Thank you, Gabriella.
Mm-hmm.
We have with us the very famous Alex DeRosi, not only a former Santa Cruz 11 man, but also a video journalist and a writer for the Indie Bay. Your most recent work, I haven't seen on Indie Bay, but I saw it elsewhere, a video about the street performers who are being harassed by hospitality or hostile hospitality people. And I'll interview you more later if and when. How can people find that? Just go on video and look on YouTube to find that video?
Well, that's YouTube. You can search YouTube and Alex DeRosi, AlexDaRosi. And, yeah, that's my YouTube channel. There's a lot of different YouTube or videos on there from Santa Cruz. But that's...
street performers might find it as a two words might be the good key word.
Street performers, but, yeah, that'll be it. And it was on Indie Bay also in an article form. But, yeah, that's... I think I did that in the fall of 2012.
Wow, really? That long ago?
Yeah.
And then you did an excellent article for on the San Lorenzo Park harassment about the same time, I think.
Yeah, that was last summer, so summer of 2013 on that one.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I imagine they cleared the park out even more since then, huh? I noticed when on that visit that there were just a fraction of the people that used to hang out there.
Well, I know that I've heard that they're now stopping people from crossing the bridge with their dogs through the park. At least I was told this by several people, because dogs, as you know, are a no-no in the park, unless, of course, it's a fashionable poodle with an appropriately fashionable owner.
Of course, or if it's a yuppie jogging through.
Fair enough. Any thoughts about this upcoming March hearing? Any predictions? Any nostalgic memories? Any traumatic recollections?
It's more like traumatic psychic predictions, unfortunately. It's not going to be fun going through the trial for this one, I don't think.
You went to at least 10 hearings, no?
Boy, a lot of hearings. Yeah, I can't remember for us specifically. But
you and Bradley were the first two that actually got charges dismissed, then refiled, then finally dismissed again.
Yeah, that was a horrible feeling to have, you know, the charges dismissed and then refiled. You know, it doesn't seem just, but, you know, we beat them in the end when we had, our good verdict, Judge Verdict. That visiting judge from Monterey was just a real whack job. You know, he had this long list of what we had to prove to him to be journalists. You know, we had to take notes and just, a million different...
Fox News ID card?
Yeah, probably. He came up with it pretty arbitrarily, and my attorney pretty much answered everything. You know, I have pretty much everything. We even had an expert witness testify that the photos could be notes. You know, it was a real narrow view that judge had, but that won't be in play for the trial. No visiting judges for the trial. So,
and I guess the issue of journalism might come up again. I mean, Brent is obviously doing a lot of videoing. He's done a lot of work. He perhaps is not regularly employed, but in that capacity, but he does do stuff that is in the public domain for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know he's...
I'm talking about Brent Adams, one of the Santa Cruz remaining final four of the Santa Cruz 11, who's going to be facing these charges in March, along with Gabriella Cameron and Frank, also known as Angel.
He's spoken about that. His defense has spoken about that a bit, so it'd be interesting to hear or see if he pulls that out of the bag. But I almost think that might be a distraction for his case. I know they can go several different ways, you know, with his defense. So that I imagine they're going to pick one or the other. They're not just going to do a everything but the kitchen sink defense.
He's going to be accused of disposing of trash from the building, a notorious crime.
I think they might be centering it around things like that. That Brent was actually actively working to,
cleaning up the whole scene
to prevent anything strange.
Gabriella, as mediator, stopping violence is another criminal action.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly wouldn't have turned out that way if there weren't the more moderate voices like theirs involved with the whole demonstration. But they certainly weren't the ones that had anything to do with, you know, the vandalism.
And what I'm referring to is a photo that shows Brent Adams coming out of the building with a garbage can to clean up the area. I think that's what the garbage can was, though. He has also used it as a drum in the past, a big 50-gallon drum, and has played it downtown. I think that wasn't the purpose in this particular video. But, again, the police department was opportunistically, and the DA presenting evidence, well, presenting video to the DA of activists that were our longtime thorns in their side. I mean, Brent was an outspoken supporter of Peace Camp 2010 for a while. I, of course, have been a critic of police misconduct and city council boondoggery for a long time. And, you know, that's, I think, and has to say, even though I maybe can, both of us are familiar landmarks, the opportunity to pick off the people that they consider to be leaders, and I don't think we're really leaders. You know, we're outspoken, more like they say gadflies, but I would say people who speak our minds and aren't afraid to some point to challenge things a bit further than folks who are, you know, well, we're willing to go a step further in challenging by standing up to police authority in ways that many people would find dangerous, because they would consider to do that might provoke police violence and or might provoke prosecution or might provoke retaliation of some kind. And it's ironic, though. The more you stand up, the less likely they are to retaliate against you in some cases, because they don't, you know, they don't want to further the publicity you're getting around the abuses that you are exposing. I'm going to play more of this on Sunday and kind of leave it for now, because I want to play a little something from Portland, Oregon, that Rutabaga Rick, one of our Florida correspondents, has sent in. And this is a story which is from the, Al Jazeera America. Portland, Oregon residents tell mayor, stop arresting homeless people. And the story reads, residents of Portland, Oregon gathered in front of City Hall on Tuesday to protest the government's treatment of its homeless population. The group, self-described angry mob, carried pitchforks and torches while demanding that Mayor Charlie Hales end policies that criminalize homelessness. The city government has come under fire in recent months for enforcing an ordinance that prohibits camping on public property, which critics say unfairly targets the homeless. A 2013 city count found nearly 1,900 individuals in the Portland metropolitan area to be homeless and unsheltered, a 10% increase from 2011. Protesters shared video and photos from the event online. In the video below, a demonstrator says, we demand that Charlie Hales immediately stop arresting homeless people. We demand that our city council stop making homelessness a crime. There's some signs, bad mayors sweeping people like crumbs. You know, like blankets, it says, with the caricature of the mayor. And here's a little of the audio from the video on that particular video.
Angry mobs! Angry mobs at City Hall! Angry mobs! Pitchfork wielding angry mobs!
We demand that Charlie Hales stops criminalizing homelessness. We demand that Charlie Hales stops confiscating blankets from the people who need them the most.
Yeah!
We demand the end to clean sweep streets.
Yeah! Yeah!
We demand an end to the camping ban.
Yeah.
We demand that these vacant buildings be used to house human beings.
Yeah.
Right to live.
It's okay.
Right to live.
Right to breathe.
Right.
And they're actually carrying torches. And it's interesting, I think, and the only time in Santa Cruz when I remember torches or an open fire being a part of a protest, it was in one of the DIY New Year's Eve parades when they called out the fire truck to come out and hose down the barrel. It was ridiculous. Anyway, here's a little more of that. We are running up against Uncle Dennis's time, not quite yet. He should be coming into the studio soon. I will be back on Sunday with hopefully some more updates and certainly a lot more audio. And who knows, you know, maybe Michael O'Grady, if he can find a place to sleep at night without getting pneumonia. You're outside, isn't that right, Michael?
I have been the last few days at least.
And I know that there is a certain controversy in the Huff meeting about what to do about violence that seems to have been some stabbings at the Homeless Lack of Services Center between two people who got into a fight. And this upsets some of our members a lot. They want to make sure that the violent people are somehow rationed off from that area. Others are saying that it's, you know, unfortunately goes with the territory. There's not much that can be done because a lot of the pressures that are on the people will create that kind of violence. When you cram people together, they'll start snapping at each other like rats in a crowded cage. But we're going to be talking more about that. And again, we'll be having a protest and information gathering and coffee distributing.